Hello, everybody. I hope you're all here for the course in classical economics, because that's what I'm going to be lecturing about. Someone's here for the wrong course. This is the time to take care of that. I remember once years ago, I was at a Mises University program where was at Stanford, there were a number of alternatives people had in some of the sessions you could have, go to different classes. And one of them was offered by Richard Vedder of Ohio State. Had a very good sense of humor. So there were two people in the class who, as soon as they saw that it was what the class was, I guess they wasn't the class they wanted, they got up and left just as the class was starting. So as they reached the door, Vedder yelled out, "I didn't want you here anyway." So I thought that was one of the better ones, at least at that Mises University. Now, what we're going to be doing in this course is we're going to go through the second volume of Murray Rothbard's book, An Austrian Perspective on the History of Economic Thought. And if you've had a chance to look at the book, you'll see it covers, besides economic theory, it covers all sorts of other topics as well. Rothbard had a very broad concept of what was to be included in economic history. He has some straight history, political philosophy. There are all sorts of things in the book. So this course in reading the book is a good way to get a general understanding of some important philosophical concepts and historical trends, as well as some very important notions about 19th century economics, which is really essential if you want to understand Austrian economics. You need to know what is the system it was reacting against, the classical economics of David Ricardo and John Stuart Mill. We'll be devoting some time in the lectures to discussing that. I should say, for those of you who took the course on volume one of the book, one way this volume is different from volume one, it includes more straight economic theory than the previous volume. In the previous volume, Rothbard tended to write a lot about other topics besides economics. But here, although, as I said before, he has a lot on history and political philosophy, there's more of a concentration on economics. Now, for those of you who haven't taken a class in the Mises Academy before, haven't taken any of my classes, I'll just say a little bit about the mechanics of the course. There are six lectures. I normally lecture for about an hour or so, and then the rest of the time we have discussions and questions, whatever you'd like to talk about. And I also offer, just strictly voluntary for anyone who wants to take it, I have a weekly quiz, just so you can see how, if you want to see how well you're getting some of the basic facts in the lecture. There's a weekly quiz which consists of 10 multiple choice questions. I should say I try to make these quizzes easy. I'm not trying to trick you. Not that I'm capable of doing such a thing, but I think it's better just to be nasty to people that whose books you're reviewing rather than my students. I try to be nice to my students since they've been nice enough to take my class. Now, what I want to start off with before getting into the topic of today's lecture, Jean-Baptiste Say, the French economist and scholars, I want to say a bit about what Rothbard is trying to do in the two volumes of his economic history. We could ask, well, there are lots of economic histories already were around before Rothbard was writing. Why did he see the need to write a new one? Now, what Rothbard's one of his main purposes is he wants to combat what he sees as an older standard view of economic history. So the way many people writing about the history of economics write is they have a certain picture of how economics developed. And in this view, the view that he's trying to combat, economics began with a famous book by Adam Smith called The Wealth of Nations, which came out in 1776. And in this view, before Smith, economics didn't really exist. There were some people who wrote on economic topics, but Smith really created the science of economics, and then it's developed since Smith. So everything after 1776, that's important in economics, really on this view comes from developing material in the Wealth of Nations and building on that framework. So just like, say, we could say that physics, modern physics, begins with Galileo and Newton, economics begins with Adam Smith. And in the standard view, what Smith was trying to do was to refute the fallacies of the mercantilists. The mercantilists were people who said that what a state should do in its economic policy is really try to increase the supply of gold and other precious metals, and it would do this by encouraging exports and restricting imports so that more money would flow into the country. There were other aspects to mercantilism, such as usually favoring government control of the economy, favoring inflation. So the idea of a standard view is Smith got started and created the science of economics by trying to refute the mercantilists. So in this standard view, after Smith wrote Wealth of Nations, then there were a succession of great economists who came after him and who developed the science of economics further, just the same physics. After Newton, there were other physicists like James Clerk Maxwell, Einstein. Other people came after. So in economics, we have a succession of great figures such as David Ricardo and John Stuart Mill. We'll be talking about those two in this course, and as we'll see, Rothbard didn't think they were all that great. He thought Ricardo and Mill were really largely mistaken in what they said. But in the standard view, Ricardo, John Stuart Mill were great figures. Then after them came the marginalists, and we won't be getting to them in this course because they would have been dealt with in the third volume of Rothbard's history, but that was never fully written out. There are lectures that Murray gave based that give some of his ideas on what would have been in the third volume. We never actually wrote it out fully. So we would have the marginalists, Carl Menger, William Stanley Jevons, and Leon Walras. Then we'd have Alfred Marshall, the great English economist, and Lord Kane. So in this older view, as I say, that Murray Rothbard wants to combat, economics begins with Adam Smith and then develops, keeps progressing through the succession of great figures. Now, a problem that Rothbard raised just in passing for this view is, well, if economics progresses from all these great figures, what happened after Lord Keynes? He's regarded by people who hold the standard view as one of the great economists. But after him, there are other significant economists, but there isn't one who's in the standard view universally regarded as the next great figure after Keynes. So the theory kind of comes to a halt after him. Now, Rothbard, as I said, rejects this view of economic history. And he calls this the Whig interpretation of history. That's W-H-I-G, the British political party, the Whigs. There was an American party, not Whig, W-I-G. So he calls this the Whig interpretation of history. Now, what does he mean by Whig interpretation? Well, the expression comes from a British historian who taught for many years at Cambridge, Herbert Butterfield, who was a very wide-ranging historian. He wrote on, he had books on George III, on Machiavelli, Napoleon's diplomacy, history of science. He wrote on all sorts of topics, but probably his most famous essay is one called The Whig Interpretation of History. And what Butterfield criticized, he said, some historians will view all of history as leading up to where we are now. So they won't consider ideas or events in their own context. They'll just say, well, things are now very good. Say, we look at the British parliamentary system, that's the ideal system. So then we look back in the past, we say, what in the 17th century was leading to more of a parliamentary form of government over a monarchy, and we'll say that was a good thing. So we'll say the people who believed in the parliament were more progressive than the ones who opposed it. So we'll view everything from the standpoint of the present. Things just were always getting better till they reach the present. So what Butterfield said, well, you can certainly, if you hold those values, if you like British Parliament, if you like something else, you can certainly say that's the best system. But if you try to impose that on past events, you won't be able to grasp how people at the particular time were viewing events. Because remember, say in the 17th century, they didn't know what was going to happen in the 19th and 20th century. They had their own concerns. So according to Butterfield, what historians should try to do is explain things from the perspective of the people at the time and not assume that everything is leading to where we are now. How does this Whig interpretation apply to history of economics? When Butterfield spoke about this, he was mainly concerned with the English history, particularly the development of parliamentary institutions. But how does this apply to economics? Well, the view that I mentioned before, the view that says economics begins with Adam Smith and progresses by a succession of great figures, is an example of the Whig interpretation, because that things are getting better and better, and we're understanding the world better and better until we reach the present time. So things, we're always learning more. Many people have this view of the physical sciences and say, well, we know today much more about the physical world than Newton or Galileo did. We just developed by continuous progress. So the Whig interpretation of economics is similar to this. It says, since Adam Smith started economics, then economics has always been progressing. Now, Rothbard's principal criticism of the Whig interpretation is that knowledge, in his view, can be lost. And he thinks there can be blind alleys and missteps in history of economics. So things aren't always getting better and better. We're not always coming to know more. And in particular, he thinks that a basic knowledge of value theory was lost after Adam Smith. Adam Smith had a cost of production theory of value. Rothbard thinks that led economists in the 19th century, or at least many economists, onto the wrong track. So Rothbard said knowledge can be lost, so you see this is going against the Whig interpretation. Now, in his way of looking at economic history, he was very much influenced by a book published by, written by Thomas Kuhn, who was a historian of science and a philosopher of science, who taught first at Berkeley and then at Princeton. The book was called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which came out in 1962. Probably many of you have read this book. It's a very famous book. Now, what Kuhn said was, it isn't the case, he didn't write about economics, but he's mainly writing about physics and astronomy. He said, it isn't the case that new scientific theories always just refine previous theories. It isn't the case, say, that 19th century theories would just take what Newton had said and then just extend what he said or possibly correct him in parts, but still keep the same framework. Kuhn said that different scientific theories have fundamentally different assumptions. We call these very important theories paradigms. A theory would take a certain kind of experiment or a certain particular theory as an example of the proper way to proceed. And people within that paradigm would accept the assumptions, say, of that theory or experiment. So everybody within a certain paradigm would accept certain assumptions. And Kuhn thought that a new theory isn't an old theory plus improvements. You could have improvements to an old theory, but that would be working within the same paradigm. Kuhn thought, at least in certain cases, you could move to a new theory that had fundamentally different assumptions. So you applying this economics, say, you might say that, say, the Austrian theory is not a refinement of the Smith's economics or Ricardo's economics, but it's a completely different way of looking at economics. It has different assumptions. Now, one place in which very important thing where Rothbard disagrees with Kuhn is that Kuhn says, well, because these competing paradigms have fundamentally different assumptions, you can't really say that one is better than the other. They're just trying to answer different questions. And Kuhn says some of the terms of one of a paradigm are what he calls incommensurable with those of another. So something like mass for pre-Newtonian physics doesn't mean the same as mass for Newton. So what Einstein, again, talking about mass doesn't mean the same as what Newton means by it. So you can't really, in Kuhn's view, say one paradigm is unreservedly better than the one it replaces. They're asking different questions. Now, Rothbard doesn't accept it. He has very definite views of what correct doctrine is in economics, and he tends to judge economists by how closely they come to the correct view, namely the Austrian view as expounded principally by Mises. So he, although he's influenced by Kuhn, he doesn't go all the way with Kuhn. Kuhn is somewhat relativistic about whether theories are true, so the theory, at least one might say Kuhn, a theory is true just within a certain paradigm, but you can't really say this theory is true absolutely, dropping all reference to assumption. And Rothbard doesn't hold that view. He thinks there is definite truth in one particular way of looking at economics, namely the Austrian one. So in that respect, he doesn't break with the Whig interpretation as strongly as Kuhn or Butterfield did. He thinks there is such a thing as progress in economics, but where he agrees with them in attacking the Whig interpretation, he said progress doesn't have to be continuous. You can lose knowledge. And in this course, we'll be seeing both economists who, in his view, get matters right, namely Say is one example, the French school of economics, or the currency school, which we'll be talking about, Frédéric Bastiat, and those who get things wrong, such as David Ricardo and John Stuart Mill. Now, another criticism that Rothbard makes of this view is that economics begins with Adam Smith and then develops. Now I see there's a question here, does Kuhn believe that there cannot be progress in science? Well, that's a much disputed question. He thinks there can't be an unambiguous criterion of progress. I mean, he thinks he would recognize progress in certain aspects, but he doesn't think you could say one paradigm is unreservedly better than another because the new paradigm will not answer questions that were posed in the earlier paradigm. They'll just not be considered important. Okay, so Rothbard says it's wrong to say that the history of economics should just concentrate on a few great thinkers. Not that there aren't great thinkers, but he thinks that there are less important members of each economic school as well. And you have to mention those because when a particular theorist is writing, he'll often be responding to writings of particular figures. So if you ignore the minor figures, you won't be able to understand what the great theorists are saying either, because they will often be responding to people who we might not really know that much about today unless we study them. And here, Rothbard, in taking this view, is very much influenced by Cambridge historian of political thought named Quentin Skinner, who stressed very much that in history of political thought you have to consider not just the greats like Machiavelli, Hobbes, Locke, you have to consider all sorts of minor figures. Also, Rothbard thought very highly of Quentin Skinner's two-volume book called Foundations of Modern Political Thought. Now, in Rothbard's own approach to history, he tends to downplay the importance of Adam Smith in favor of first of the Spanish scholastics from an earlier period, but contemporary with Smith, he tends to stress, instead of Smith, the French tradition of Turgot and Cantillon. Cantillon wasn't French, he was born in Ireland, but he spent a great deal of time in France. So this French tradition stresses utility, how much people value particular goods and services, rather than cost of production in the way that Smith did. So the person we're going to be talking about for the rest of this lecture, Jean-Baptiste Say, fits very much into Rothbard's picture because he was a French theorist who stressed utility. And just what Rothbard wants to say is the important development of economics in the 18th century was not Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, it was what was going on in France. And for those of you who took the earlier course on Volume 1, we talked about Turgot and Cantillon. So for Rothbard, what's important is what's going on in France, not what Adam Smith was doing. But there's a problem here for Rothbard is, he wants to say is in this tradition apart from Smith that he wants to say is more insightful than what Smith was doing. But Say himself regarded himself as a follower of Adam Smith. So this poses a problem for Rothbard because he wants to say is really anti-Adam Smith, but that isn't the way Say regarded himself. So you have to ask first, how does Rothbard get around that? How does he answer that difficulty? Well, what Rothbard says is that the French economists were reluctant to stress their own French tradition because the French economists previously to Say were associated with a group called the physiocrats. And the physiocrats were regarded as largely discredited at that time. So people didn't want to say if you're a French economist, they didn't want to say, well, we're in this French tradition of economists, because then if you said that, then you'd say, oh, well, you're just a follower of the physiocrats and they're no good. Now, what was wrong with the physiocrats? Well, remember what had happened in France after there was a great revolution in 1789. The absolute monarchy was overthrown. Louis XVI was beheaded in January 1793. There was a complete upheaval in French political life. And the physiocrats, although they tended to support the largely free market, they believed in the way to they should get to get their ideas across was kind of get the ear of the king. So they supported the absolute monarchy. So they were regarded as politically suspect. And even Turgot, who wasn't a physiocrat, was really classed by most of the people at the time as having been a physiocrat. Another thing people didn't like about the physiocrats was they held some of their views were very implausible. For example, they thought that only agriculture was productive, and they believed that all taxes should come from agriculture because agriculture was the only really productive form of labor. Kind of perhaps a rather weird view, but that was the view they held. So Rothbard says, well, Say didn't want to call himself a French theorist because he would have associated with the physiocrat. And he also points out that despite calling himself a Smithian, Say had many criticisms of Smith. So he says, well, I'm a follower of Adam Smith. But then when you look at what he says, he very often will have something very critical of Smith. For example, Smith said Smith wasn't very systematic. He just has all these haphazard observations, so he wasn't really systematic. And as we'll see, Say's views were very often in direct contrast to Smith. So Rothbard is, the objection he gave to Rothbard was, well, you say Say is in this anti-Smith tradition, but he calls himself a follower of Smith. It doesn't really hold up because, in fact, Say had a lot of criticism of Smith. Now, Say's most important book was his treatise, which in French is Traité. First edition was published in 1803, and it went through about six more editions. It kept getting bigger. Now, one point that Rothbard stresses very much in his discussion with Say, he thinks is very important, is that Say was really the first economist to write explicitly about economic method. One of the topics of economics is how do you study economics? What is the best way of proceeding if you want to study economics? How should the economist work? That's a topic within economics, economic method. And Rothbard thinks that when he was, say, was talking about method, he anticipated what Mises called praxeology, which is the science of human action. Now, to understand Say's view on method, I think we have to first look at a question he asked was, is economics an empirical science? He didn't use the word empirical, but this is what he had in mind. And what he was asking was, does economics deal with the real world? Is it about the real world? And he answered, yes, economics is about the real world. He was very influenced by the British philosopher and statesman, Sir Francis Bacon, who wrote about inductive sciences. So Say says economics is about the actual world, the world that we live in. And he criticized the physiocrats, remember the group we talked about before that everybody was trying to repudiate. Oh, wait, there's a question here. Daniel, is that what Menger meant when he called economics empirical too? Yes, that's a very good question. Yes, I think that's right. I mean, that economics is empirical rather than mathematical. It's not something that's just introducing certain axioms or postulates and seeing what follows from them. It's actually dealing with what happens in the real world. So Say said, the physiocrats and Ricardo, who was his contemporary, were doing this. They were introducing arbitrary axioms that let's make certain assumptions, see what happens if we make those assumptions. And then if you do that, then these assumptions might not at all apply to the real world. So you can deduce what you like from them, but you're not guaranteed that what you come up with will be true of the world. And I find one reason I'm stressing this point is that when people are studying praxeology and Austrian economics today, there's a point that's often missed. Sometimes people will ask, I've had this happen many times when I lecture on praxeology at Mises University, people will say, well, in praxeology what you do is talk about the concept of action, of human action, and we try to make deductions from it. But they say, how do we know that what we deduce really applies to the world? They take it as if, well, praxeology is just talking about certain kind of mental constructions that Mises or Rothbard have, seeing what falls from them. But this isn't right. What we're doing in praxeology, and Say realizes, is we're talking about what's going on in the actual world. And if we're going to understand praxeology, what we're dealing with in Austrian economics is actions that occur in the real world, like an action, something like my giving a talk or going out for dinner, is not just some kind of mental idea. Like some people will even ask questions like, well, how do we know that the ideas that I come up with, one comes up with in praxeology, apply to other people? We're not trying to solve, we're not Cartesian skeptics. We're trying to deduce the existence of the external world. We're dealing with the actual world in economics. This is the point, say, stressed very much. So, well, if we want to deal with the actual world, the real world, well, how do we proceed? Now, say, distinguish between what he called general facts and variable or particular facts. General facts are facts that are always the same. They don't change. For example, the general fact will be that people act to achieve their goals. That isn't something that changes. People might have different goals from time to time, but it's always the case that human beings will act to achieve their ends or goals. So economics, in Say's view, is concerned with these general facts. So if they're always the same, they don't change. They don't require testing. We don't have to find out, say, if people really act, or we just know this because it's a common fact of experience, things we know that don't change. And if we take account of those, then we can say, well, what are the consequences of these general facts? Well, we can think about them and reason about them. Deductively, we can ask what follows, say, from the concept of action, and then we'll be able to arrive at knowledge about it. So we don't have to come up with some model based on assumptions that may not be true, and then test out whether the model is confirmed by, see whether it enables us to predict what's happening in economics, as Say conceives of it. We start with certain general facts we know to be true, and then we draw consequences from it. Now, Say also thought that mathematics and here's a question. Are general facts the same as a priori propositions? They don't have to be. Now, an a priori proposition is one we know to be true without testing and experience. But, I mean, there could be propositions like there's more than one person in the world, or people engage in buying and selling. Those would be general propositions that we wouldn't know them apart from experience. They're not one we could just say, thinking about people, it wouldn't follow that there's more than one person or that people engage in buying and selling, but we would know that it's a general fact to experience, so we'd still be able to talk about it. And Danny points out this utility of labor is not considered by Mises to be an a priori proposition. And then one funny way to explain what an a priori proposition is, kind of to get you so you know what that is, suppose you say something like, I say it's sunny outside. So if you want to know if that's true, well, you have to go outside and see whether it's sunny, or test it in some other way. But if you say, if it's sunny outside, then it's sunny outside, you don't need to test that. That's something you know to be true. That's a priori. So Say thought that mathematics isn't really suited for economics, because if you're trying to say what determines or causes a particular economic fact, like say, why is the price of books, many books will be in the $20 to $30 range today. Why is that the case? Well, there are too many variable events that help determine that for mathematical or statistical analysis to be useful. So another very important point that Say makes, and I think this is one that has a great deal of contemporary relevance is that because there are so many variables involved in explaining a particular economic event, you can't explain what happens without appealing to an economic theory. For example, some people argue, say, mentions prosperous nations very often have a high tariff policy. Say, the United States in the early 20th century was growing very rapidly economically, but there was had a high tariff policy. So people say, well, tariffs cause prosperity. Now, if you argue that way, that isn't legitimate because we would need some kind of theoretical account to show why high tariffs will lead to prosperity. Otherwise, all we have is a statement that tariffs accompany prosperity. We wouldn't have any justification just if we said, well, look, the U.S. was prosperous in such and such years, but we also had high tariffs, though it doesn't show tariffs are really a good thing if you want prosperity. Well, no, it doesn't show that at all, because you need some theoretical framework to try to show how the tariffs will lead to prosperity. And in fact, it might have been the case that a particular country would have done even better with free trade. In fact, in this particular example, we have good theoretical reasons to think this, that free trade will lead to greater economic prosperity than high tariff policy, because free trade increases the extent to which the division of labor can operate. Remember, division of labor is a very important concept. You'd say people are much more productive instead of each person trying to produce everything for himself or herself. Say I tried to build my own house or grow my own food, I wouldn't get very far, but instead I should specialize in what I do best and then trade with other people to get what I want. And the more we can trade with others, the greater the extent of the specialization possible, so people will have greater productivity and prosperity if they can increase the division of labor. And one point Rothbard makes about Say is that he thinks Say had much more insight into the division of labor than Adam Smith did. Adam Smith, remember the Wealth of Nations begins with a famous example about how division of labor makes a pin factory much more productive than if each person had to do all the operations involving making a pin by himself. If you divide up the task, then you'll be much more productive. But the problem is Smith tends to emphasize just division of labor within a particular job. He didn't emphasize so much division of labor between various, not just within a single firm, but between industries or firms all over the world. So he didn't really grasp, according to Rothbard, the extent to which division of labor was important, and Say did. Now, as I mentioned previously, this is where Rothbard contrasts the Adam Smith view and view of Smith and his successors like Ricardo with the French tradition. Smith stressed cost of production, in especially labor costs. If, say, you wanted to know why a book costs $20, Smith would say, well, how much did the labor cost to produce the book, or how much did it cost to make the materials that you use to in printing and making the book. Now, Say went the other way. He said you should explain prices through appeal to the utility of the consumer. So prices depend on what consumers want rather than on how much it costs to produce a particular good. Say, according to Say, what's important is what the consumers want, how the consumers value a product. Now, he realized that when we talk about the utility of a good, the utility is to someone is relative to how the person ranks other goods, say, how much, say, I value a particular book will depend, say, on how that ranks against other things I could buy with the same amount of money. In modern economics, that would be called the utility scale. So he realized that ranking a good or saying it has utility, it involves ranking the good relative to other goods. Now, Say did not have a concept that some of the Spanish scholastics and Turgot and Cantillon had, marginal utility, which is, suppose you have a supply of a number of units of a good, the marginal utility is the utility to you of the last unit of the good. And this concept of marginal utility is essential to solve what's called the diamond water paradox. Probably a lot of you know that it was one of the basic problems for economists who said the utility, the price of a good depends on the utility of the good. So objectors said, well, look, you say that price depends on utility, but water is much more useful to human beings than diamonds are. Diamonds are a luxury, but if we don't have water, we would die. Water is really essential. So by your theory, water has much more utility, so it should have a higher price than diamonds, but water usually doesn't have a price at all. You can get water for free, and diamonds have a very high price. So in order to solve this, we have to take account that in considering the price of a good, we're not concerned with the price of a total quantity of the good, how much of the good there is in the whole world. We're just concerned with the price of a particular unit for sale. And if we have a lot of water, then an additional unit of water will be worth little or nothing. So water doesn't cost very much or doesn't cost anything because there's so much of it, and the marginal unit doesn't have a high value, and diamonds cost a lot, but have a high price because there aren't very many of them considering the amount of diamonds people want. So in order to solve this diamond water paradox, you need the concept of marginal utility, but Say didn't have that, even though he stressed the importance of utility in determining price and value. Now, one of the important concepts of economics that's really fundamental, we'll see this is very important when we talk about Marxism in one of the lectures, it's a point that you can use against Marx's labor theory of value, is that in an exchange, each person values what he gets more than what he gives up. For example, all of you paid a certain amount to enroll in this course, so that means you'd rather listen to my lectures than have the amount of money you paid. Of course, now you're all regretting you made that choice, but that's something else. So the point would be, why would you make an exchange unless you'd rather have what you get than what you give up? It seems like a pretty elementary point, easy to grasp, but a lot of people in the history of thought rejected that. Aristotle rejected that. Aristotle and others thought that exchange involves an equality. In exchange, the each item exchange has to have the same economic value. If it doesn't, then somebody's taking advantage of somebody else. So Say, unfortunately, although he had a lot of good insights about utility, Say wrongly thought that when an exchange takes place, the good had or equal value. And as Danny points out, Say was a step back from Turgot. Yes, Turgot certainly had the view that exchange involves this inequality. Each person values what he gets more than what he gives out. So to see what was wrong with his view, Say should have said, well, Say said the goods exchange of equal value, should have asked equal to whom? Who is the one who says they're equal value? Well, no one who's making the exchange would say that. Each person would have a different valuation of the goods. Now, I should just mention, just in passing, if you're reading the chapter, when Rothbard is discussing it, there's a typo on page 20 of the chapter that destroys the sense of the sentence in which it occurs. And I put this down for it in paragraph 2, line 4. In the sentence starts out, but Condillac insists, and it should be, but Say insists. So if you're reading that chapter, be sure to note that correction. Does anyone know about that? I don't know that. I just noted it when I was reading over the chapter to prepare this lecture. I don't know if anyone else has noted that. I assume so, but I don't really know. Say's views on utility differed entirely from David Ricardo's theory. Now, Ricardo acknowledged that only a good with utility would have a positive price. Suppose, I just decided I paint a picture and I'm a terrible artist, so absolutely nobody thinks my pictures of any value. So if a good doesn't have any utility to anybody, nobody would buy it, nobody would pay anything. It wouldn't matter. Suppose I'd worked 10 years on my painting, nobody wants it. It wouldn't matter how much labor had been required to make it. So Ricardo agreed with that. He said, well, you're right. Of course, a good has to have utility in order to have a positive price. But in his view, once a good has utility, then it's the labor cost that determines the price. So you need utility, the necessary condition for value, but it doesn't determine the amount of value. So that's a very different theory from Say's. Now, one of Say's insights was he applied the emphasis on utility to factors of production also. I mean, it seems pretty straightforward to say, take a consumer's good like a book or these lectures, say, what's the price of that? Well, that would depend on how much the people who want to buy are willing to pay for it. But Say realized this applies to factors of production as well. And the value of a factor of production like land or labor would depend on how much it will help to produce a good the consumers want. In other words, the value of a consumption good determines the value of the production good, because the production good will be valued according to how it contributes to producing the consumer's good. Now, what about production goods that are used to make other production goods? For example, a machine that's used to make other machines. Well, their value is determined by the value of the good they helped produce. So just like the value of the first level production good is determined by the value of the consumer's good it helped produce, then the value of the second level production good will be determined by its contribution to the value of the first level production goods, so it kind of goes in stages. So the prices are ultimately, if everything is ultimately determined by the consumer's goods, then you have first level production goods, their value is determined by value of consumer's goods, then you have what is the value, what's required to produce those things, and you get, you can trace it back till you get higher and higher in the stages of production. And this stage of production analysis was carried much further than, say, had done by von Bauberg, great early Austrian economist, and other Austrians. So Say really helped pioneer stage of production analysis. Now, another great contribution of Say was, where he was different from Smith, was that he stressed the entrepreneur. You don't get production of good automatically just by, say, well, you need, for any good, you need land, labor, and capital goods. You have to have someone who will bring all these factors of production together and actually produce the item. So somebody has to speculate, somebody has to say, well, I think if we produce such and such a thing, then we'll make money. Somebody will have to bring the factors of production together to do that. It's usually a capitalist, someone with money, who will do this, who will bring all the factors of production together. So usually the entrepreneur is the capitalist, not just someone who comes up with the idea. It wouldn't be a good idea to produce something, but somebody who actually has the funds and does it. So when the entrepreneur does this, what is he doing? He's advancing money to the owners of the factories of production. Say, suppose I'm an entrepreneur and I have a factory, so I have all these people working for me. Well, I'm not going to get any money till I sell the product to the factory, but the workers don't have to wait, don't have to wait till I make my profit. I have to pay them for their labor right after when they're laboring. So I have to really lend them the money on speculation, give them money on speculation that I'll be able to get enough to cover my payments plus get a profit. So I have to pay them before I sell the product. So the entrepreneur is thus taking on considerable speculative risk. I shouldn't have said he's not lending the money to the workers and the other owners of resources. He's giving them the money, but he's taking the risk that he might not get it not be recompensed from his sales. So it's essential that he have good powers of judgment, because otherwise he'll go broke. Now let's see, there's Dan said, did Say believe in direct value imputation? Did he recognize the necessity of economic calculation in allocating higher order goods based on the value of lower order goods? Well, I think he really didn't write an enormous amount about it, but I think he would recognize that you would need economic calculation. He didn't believe, as Schumpeter did, that there's kind of a direct imputation, that once you have the price of the consumer's good, that directly determines the price of all these other goods higher up. In fact, that would be inconsistent with what he says about the importance of the entrepreneur, because the pricing would very much depend on the speculation of the entrepreneur, so it wouldn't be by any kind of direct imputation in the sense of a deterministic process. So that's a very good question. Now, if you mention Say to a contemporary economist, he's probably, what the person will think about is Say's law of markets, which was famously attacked by Lord Keynes in General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, which came out in 1936. Now, Rothbard thinks that say was right, that Keynes and others who criticized him were wrong. Now, what the law of markets is, I think it's really crazy to understand, is that the demand for goods and services consists of a supply of other goods and services. Supposing, say, we imagine, we can see this in a bartering economy, but let's say we have somebody who grows apples, somebody else grows oranges. So each one wants to buy some of what the other one has. So what, say, constitutes the demand, say, of the person who wants apples? Well, it's his having oranges that the other person wants. And similarly, the one who, similarly the other way around, so the demand for oranges consists of the apples, demand for apples consists of the oranges. So demand, not just in the sense of what you want, but what you have the means to pay for, consists of other commodities. So what happens though if you introduce money? Well, that doesn't really change anything because money is just another commodity. So demand for one commodity is really the supply of some other commodity. So what follows if we realize this is that there can't be general overproduction. There can't be overproduction of everything because that would mean if you couldn't have overproduction of everything because just because the demand for one thing is the supply of something else, and human wants are unlimited, so we couldn't reach a stage where we just satisfy all human wants and there's nothing more to be produced. All we would have would be producing certain things that will enable one to produce that thing to buy other things. Now, of course, we could have too much or too little production of particular goods and services because entrepreneurs make mistakes, but we couldn't have overproduction of everything as long as people have wants that these goods, the goods are satisfying. Now, sometimes you'll see the law stated supply creates its own demand, but that isn't a very good formulation of it because the supply of one good isn't usually demand for the same good. It's usually supply of one good is demand for other goods. So that isn't the proper way to state Say's law. Now, Rothbard thinks that Say was especially good when he wrote Bob asked a good question. Why did Keynes consider Say's error to be such a big issue? Well, that's a very good question because, you see, what Keynes said is money changes things. So Keynes thought there can be general overproduction in a monetary economy where people are just producing things, but they aren't buying it. When people spend, it doesn't cover everything that's being produced. So the government then has to spend money so that total production won't fall. So Say's law, combating Say's law is really essential to Keynes' view, because if Say's law is true, then there isn't this problem of production turning out to be greater than consumption, so making the government have to come in and make up the deficit. In Say's law is true, people will always want the total amount of there won't be a situation where every commodity is produced in a greater amount than people want. We could have mistakes, but there couldn't be general overproduction. So on taxation, Rothbard, again, if you like, do contrast, say, with Adam Smith. Adam Smith tried to establish what he called canons of taxation, such as ability to pay, like rich people should be taxed more because they can pay more, not progressively more, but just proportionately more. But for say it should have been capitalist, all taxation was bad. Taxation should be as low as possible. Now why did he think that? Because he thought the state was really a predatory body. It wasn't something that the state isn't a product, part of productive economy. It was just taking resources from some people, something like imagine a type of thief on a much bigger scale. Just taking resources. So if we have a thief, we want to have him steal as little as possible, preferably nothing. So taxes should be as low as possible. Now, one of Say's most important colleagues was Destu de Trossy, who wrote on economics and also politics, wrote a commentary on Montesquieu. And he coined the term ideology. He meant by the study of human action. Today, sometimes ideology means kind of a system of ideas that reflects a certain class interest that is not based on reality, but kind of distorts the subject in favor of certain class interests, that kind of a Marxist view of ideology. But that wasn't what de Trossy meant by this. So he shared Say's views that were very critical of the free critical of government in favor of the free market. And both of them, de Trossy and Say, were opposed to Napoleon. Remember, they become emperor, French emperor in 1804. Not incidentally emperor of France, French emperor. And we can spend months to ask about the discussion. I'll mention why that's important. So both de Trossy and Say were opponents of Napoleon. He attacked them. Say had actually been an important official in the directory, which was the government that immediately preceded Napoleon. And de Trossy and also Say influenced Thomas Jefferson, who had shared their hard money views. Both de Trossy and Say were opposed to inflation and having the banks issue more money than they had reserves on hand. So they were against paper money, government debt, and high taxes, and this influenced Jefferson's views on these matters. And Jefferson, as a matter of fact, translated part of de Trossy's commentary on Montesquieu himself and arranged for someone else to translate the foreword, and he also helped in the translation of Say's treatise. So, that was pretty important. I see a question from Danny. Did Say formulate the law of markets to refute Malthus's pre-Keynesian under consumption thing? No, he came up with the law first, and then Malthus objected to him, especially the objections from Malthus and also Sismondi, who was an Italian living in Switzerland. After the end of the Napoleonic Wars, 1815, there was a depression in Europe, and then people said, well, look, doesn't this depression show that you can have general overproduction? So Malthus and Sismondi attacked Say, and Say replied to them, but Say had come up with his views first. Well, I think we'll stop now. So in the time left, you can ask questions. I guess you could put the question either in the chat or in the Q&A or whatever is better. I'll open both so you can put anything wherever you like. I think we have a fairly small group. don't all rush to be the first one to ask a question. Here's one. Let's see, Justin said he once asked, did Rothbard think there was a meaningful distinction between relativism and nihilism in relation to Kuhn specifically? Well, I think he didn't tend to treat Kuhn as a relativist. I think he pretty much put aside that aspect of Kuhn. But I don't think relativism and nihilism would be really the same position. I mean, a relativist would say something is, instead of talking about truth, sort of sans France, just truth by itself, we should talk about truth relative to something. There'd be different types of relativists depending on what they think the truth is relative to. And a nihilist would be someone who doesn't think there's any truth at all. So I think they wouldn't be the same position. I mean, there are certainly all sorts of problems with relativism, but I don't think it's the same position as nihilism. Now, Thomas wants to know, outside of, say, his unfamiliarity with Marginal Utility, at what other major points did his theory diverge with the traditional Austrian theory? Well, one was, as I mentioned in the lecture, he didn't accept an exchange involves a double inequality. See, that wouldn't fall. If you could accept marginal utility with and still hold that exchange involves equal value, so they're separate points. Now, another thing was, Say didn't at all times completely free himself from cost of production views, although he certainly tended in that direction. But I think the basic thing wasn't so much that he differed with the Austrians, that he hadn't developed his theory to the extent that the Austrians later did, but he pioneered many of the concepts later used by the Austrians. But one thing I'll just mention, when I talked about method, I said that you can't say that it's improper if you say, well, look, prosperity has been accompanied by high tariffs, so therefore doesn't show high tariffs is a good idea. You need some kind of theoretical account. Well, you still find people arguing exactly that mistaken way today. For example, Pat Buchanan, who I know has generally got along with him very well, but he makes just that argument. He says, well, look, these economists come up with all these theories, but look, didn't the U.S. do very well with a high tariff policy? But I mean, Say already showed what was wrong with that argument in the early 19th century, but people are still using it. Now, Hossein says, how do we check on economic theory and improve on it? Well, I think we just think about the arguments and try to come up with, see if there are any problems with them, try to come up with new arguments when new problems arise, and we try to analyze them according to the concepts we have and possibly come up with new ideas. Sometimes we can progress by trying to refute views that other people have that we think are mistaken. It's hard to answer that in a kind of a general way, but those would be some things we could do. Now, let's see, next one is, Bob says, do you think Rothbard is a little too hard on Smith? Well, I think what he's trying to do is stressing certain things. Remember, in his book, he's concerned with this tradition, what he called the good tradition, which is the one that stresses utility, and then the bad tradition is the one that stresses cost production. So Smith is in the bad tradition. Now, I think Smith's most important positive contributions are more in moral philosophy, and Rothbard doesn't really write about that much. So I think you could get some more positive treatment of certain themes in Smith, but Rothbard is just concerned with certain points that he wants to stress that he thinks Smith is mistaken. So I don't think he's intending to offer a comprehensive portrait of Smith, but he's just thinking within the, if you consider the particular questions he's asking, he thinks Smith doesn't do very well. Now, Jacob, Justin, also, if you're familiar with Chomsky's work on logic, if so, could you please comment on its relevance here, if any? Well, unfortunately, I haven't gone over that work much. I don't think that his work in logic really got anywhere. I think he was pretty much what they call an associationist, kind of a follower of a particular school of psychology that I don't think really got anywhere. But I really have to look into that more. I could be entirely mistaken on that. I don't think he's usually regarded as an important logician. We have, the gang says, we have a t-shirt with a picture, say, that says market's clear. We developed market clearing price theory, or does Islam market have any direct implications regarding market clearing? Well, I think it would apply to, say, just in the sense, more in the sense that he thinks there can't be general overproduction. So, I think it would be more accurate if we phrased this t-shirt. It's not the case that all markets fail to clear, but that wouldn't really be very good on a t-shirt, would it? I don't think, and I could be wrong, but I don't think he worked out in detail how markets clear, although he did have to say that if there was overproduction or underproduction in a certain market, then resources would shift either out or into the market. So he did have some of the ideas in how the market clearing would take place. So I mean, he had some of it, but as I say, I'm using the word fail a lot in talking about it, but this was developed later by other people, but I think he had some of the basic ideas. Now let's see, here is one. Mike says, given the relative similarities in Say and Smith on many points, Say self-identified as Smith, is Rothbard identifying the value base of goods as services a core concept in Say, defying the two different paradigms, future option, future change, and keying on it originating at this point in history? Well, I think he does think that the different value theory is one of the most essential points in separating this tradition he likes and the one he doesn't like, cost of production versus the stress on utility. But it doesn't originate, cost of production really didn't originate with Smith. There were other people who had that idea before, and he discusses that in Volume 1. Say didn't originate the stress on utility. What Rothbard does in Volume 1, he discusses a lot of people. There's the Spanish scholastics, Chirico, Cantillon, who really worked out a value theory based on utility. So it's right that this is a basic difference between Smith and Say, but this isn't the origin of that dispute. It's just an important phase in that conflict. Now, Gang said, if Say was so different from Smith, how was it that he was considered such a French Smithian champion? Well, one thing was, remember, he described himself as a Smithian. And another point that Rothbard mentioned, maybe I should have mentioned this in the lecture, is that Say wrote in an extremely clear style. So a lot of people, when they read Say, they thought, well, he's writing such a clear style, he can't really be that original. He must just be an expounder of other people's views. And Rothbard mentions that J.R. McCullough, who was a follower of Ricardo, was very good at keeping up with economic literature. He wrote bibliographies on economics. You would say is just a popularized because he was a clear stylist. I mean, sometimes I think sometimes this happens. Say we find this in philosophy. Sometimes writers who have very difficult styles, like Heidegger or Hegel, people think, well, they have to be really profound because they're so hard to understand. And so sometimes people who write very simply are considered not so profound. So I think this happened to Say, but he was viewed more as a follower because people didn't realize he was really coming up with a lot of insights because he was so easy to understand. Now let's see, Steve asked, does Say's law of market imply that economic downturns should end fairly quickly through price theory? Well, I don't think that's a strict implication of the law, because I think since there couldn't be general overproduction, it would imply that if there was overproduction in a particular area and resources did shift out of that area into other areas, that would end the problem. I don't think it's an implication that that would have to happen. You could see reasons why it would happen. It wouldn't follow logically that from the fact there can't be general overproduction, that people will correct their whatever mistakes they make fairly quickly. That would not follow, I don't think. Danny said, how do the French subjectivism come and the British non-subjectivism both come to such consistently anti-Mercantilist positions, such different approaches? What was the common thread, if any? Well, that's a very good question. I think one thing there is that the main arguments against mercantilism, at least some of the main arguments, don't depend on the adoption of a particular value theory. For example, supposing I mentioned this point on division of labor is more productive than failure to specialize, and the more trade that you have, the greater the division of labor. Well, you could see that even if you adopt a cost of production theory. You could see that that argument was true, and that was an argument that the Smith and his Ricardo had. They realized this. They realized Ricardo extended, showed that trade could be beneficial even if one person is more productive in everything he produces, or one country is more productive in everything they produce in another country. Trade is still beneficial. So that argument isn't dependent on Ricardo's adopting his particular view of how prices are determined. So I think at least part of the answer to the question is that the arguments, some of the arguments against Mercantilism don't depend on the points of issue between the two schools of value. Yes, that's right. At least that argument depended on sheer physical prototype, not valuation. That's right. Yes. I mean, just like the parts of economics that are like that the law of returns is dependent on physical productivity. And I mean, could we also, could have arguments, say, just in fact that you adopt an incorrect value theory doesn't mean all your conclusions about from the theory are going to be false ones. Now Matthew said, can you expand on the reference to Emperor of France in the lecture? Well, what Napoleon wanted to emphasize is that his power came from, he was emperor as a result of being accepted as emperor by the French people. He was not the ruler of the French territory, so his power stemmed from the people. So we would have, say, under the monarchy, it was the king of France, not king of the French, but Napoleon wanted to emphasize his power came from the people, so he was French emperor. Now it's interesting, after the overthrow of Napoleon, then Louis XVIII, even though he was from the brother of Louis XVI, was king of the French, not king of France. And, I think you have this, say the Kaiser, that when the German Empire was proclaimed 1871, it was the German Emperor rather than Emperor of Germany. So see, this is stressing that the power is really emanating from the people of the country. Now let's see, here's another one. Danny says, since they recognize the primacy of consumer valuation with regard to production of price, did he approach Mises' doctrine of consumer sovereignty to any degree? Well, I don't think he worked that out in any detail, but he did have the notion that the goods are produced will be the ones that consumers want. I mean, I don't think he developed that point to the extent Mises did, but he did certainly have a notion that the goods and services produced in the free market will be the ones that people want. If you have a government trying to interfere with that, that will just be preventing people from getting what they want. So I think he did have that idea. Now, Matthew says, was Mises the first to stress the doctrine of consumer sovereignty? The phrase consumer sovereignty, it comes from W.H. Hutt, I think, an article in the South African Journal of Economics, if I'm not mistaken. Now, Hutt took this doctrine to extremes, and Rothbard criticizes it for that. For example, Hutt thought if you say you're laboring, you don't really have a right to withhold your own labor if your labor is in demand by consumers, but Mises never said that, but Hutt tended to take that to extremes. Consumer sovereignty is subordinate to each individual's sovereignty over its own. Yes, Rothbard said, well, each individual is sovereign over his own person. So I don't think if Mises understood consumer sovereignty, it wouldn't be different from anything Rothbard held. But Hutt held the view in such a way that Rothbard's criticisms would apply. He'd say approach marginal productivity theory at all. Rothbard doesn't think he did. No, he really didn't have the concept of a marginal unit, so you couldn't have really had marginal productivity theory. Well, okay, I guess we're, unless anybody has anything, last question, I guess we're about out of time now. So thanks very much for coming to the lecture. I hope we'll see you all next week. Thanks a lot. Thank you.